If you've been told to pull up your socks, then make sure it's a pair of TNT socks. The TNT shop is now open at TNTRadio.live. Today's News Talk Radio, TNT, with Joseph Arthur and his Technicolor Dreamcast.
It's hard out there for artists, folks. It's hard out there for everybody. Everybody's struggling. Everybody's afraid. Cryptocurrency is crashing all around. And if you're an artist, oftentimes you need a side hustle. I mean, all the way back. I remember Rimbaud. Remember the poet? He wrote all these genius poems up until he was 17. And then he ran off with a mattress full of money and had a horrible fate. Anyway, as artists, sometimes you have to find side hustles and figure it out. I just saw this Citizen Cope tweet. He said, can we come up with a different term than side hustle? Because hustle points to illegal activity. But my next guest is entrepreneurial. He has a podcast. He's gone into advertising. He's a classical musician and a filmmaker. He found himself in the advertising world. He creates compelling videos for all sorts of companies and individuals, everything from branded content to commercials to snappy social media to documentaries. His clients are among the top global bands. He's also, as I said, a classical pianist, a composer. His passion for film music is one thing that got him into visual storytelling. Plus, he does audio dramas on his podcast called Safe Society. Welcome to the show, Chris Shimojima. How are you, my friend?
Good. Great to be here.
Great to have you on. So, yeah, it seems like you're industrious. Like I can relate to you because I do all kinds of different things. I paint, I do music. Yeah. I'm here on TNT Radio, the space of truth in the news space. So you have to find different avenues to survive. And I know you're out there in New York City where survival is getting harder all the time.
It is. Yeah. No, you know, I try to be industrious for sure. It's not always easy, but, you know, I have a lot of, you know, my editing work that goes on day to day and, you know, sometimes doing commercial directing that keeps me afloat. But, you know, my real passion has always been storytelling. And for the past 10 years or so, you know, being a freelancer in it, you know, after I did a stint at an ad agency full time, I decided, okay, I'm going to go freelance so I can really spend half the time focusing more on my personal projects. It's been interesting for sure. You know, I wanted to get more into making long form stories, whether it be films or now for the first time really experimenting with the podcast format and trying to tell a long form narrative with the definitive ending through the medium.
You always hear how storytelling is really important, even in advertising, I guess, right? You have to try to tell a story because you're trying to draw people in and get them to have a personal connection with whatever you're trying to sell them.
Yeah, the difference I would say is that, and there's definitely an overlap, and it's interesting because I never thought I would get into advertising, and I sort of found myself, you know, becoming a production hand on the stage of a company coming out of college. And what I found is that so many people there, you know, did have storytelling backgrounds. They were in film school. They did do many things like that. So I really did relate to them and connect with them on many levels. Through that time there, I really kind of got the sense that, okay, this was something I could get into and, you know, find a way to tell stories through it. I would say the difference is that advertising is largely aspirational. And because of that, it can really get swayed into certain ideologies or certain things that are getting pushed. Whereas, you know, what I love doing as a storyteller is being a little critical and always questioning everything. So, you know, I those two worlds kind of stay a little bit separate for me, and they don't always get to blur in because, you know, advertising is not necessarily interested in those satirical kind of stories.
Not at all, man. If you're a dissident, forget advertising. Here's weird thing, though. Yeah, and we'll get into that. But just on the advertising train a little bit, I had friends all along. I've been, you know, a recording artist for a long time, and in New York as well, which is where you are, and we'll talk about that too. But and I had friends who were musicians, jazz, serious musicians, and they would start advertising houses. A lot of them to do just like little bits of music. And they would sometimes call me to come in to sing, you know, and it would always be like, hey, can you come sing on this spot? And we'll give you $500 or some absurd amount of money for to come in and just do something for, you know, sell your soul for 30 seconds or something, you know. But with AI, I feel like a lot of those jobs are going to go out the window because it's going to be so easy for people to just say, give me ad music for this. Give me like 10 versions of this. And generic music or AI music that might be soulless doesn't really matter in the ad world so much. Do you think a lot of these advertising jobs are going to go out the window for artists?
So I have a, you know, and this is something that I've considered a lot lately because I did try to use some of this AI tools and AI music in my series as well. And it is something that I'm sort of very, very into experimenting with and seeing where it can go. I created a trailer with AI imagery as well because I didn't have a film team behind this project. So I'm interested in using it as tools. Less as like the kind of thing where it's creating the story from you from scratch, but more as like an assistant. That's where I see the power of it really is. Of course, further down the line, things are going to change even more. But what I think is that, yes, short-term jobs will change and people's talent usages will change. And we probably won't be doing, you know, a lot of the smaller tasks or those things where you're saying where people do go into the studio and just lay some down for 30 minutes or whatever. But that said, I do think there will be other opportunities that open up from it. So AI will be able to take over those things that we don't really want to do anyways. That way we can focus on developing new content or putting our talents to use in different ways. That's my hope, you know, but who knows?
Yeah, it expands it. I write a blog over there at josepharthur.com. And sometimes I'll write a whole blog and then I'll just put, I'll go to ChatGPT, whatever, then I got a subscription to it and I'll put, give me an image for this and I'll put the whole blog in and it'll spit out something pretty amazing. I mean, it all kind of looks the same. It all looks, it has an AI look to it now and it's getting more and more recognizable as such, but I'll put it in the blog, you know, I'll put imagery with AI look to it now and it's getting more and more recognizable as such, but I'll put it in the blog, you know, I'll put imagery within it, like in between little like chapters or whatever. And it's interesting. I mean, I just look at it as a creative tool as well, but I think it's going to end up eliminating a lot of those kind of jobs because people are just going to be able to get, you know, ad music easily. I mean, and so we as artists, you know, more than ever are going to have to sort of grind harder and harder, I think, or, you know, sort of up level and implement AI tools into our own work. I'm not opposed to it. I mean, you can't really resist it. But as a filmmaker, I think it's more daunting. And this is interesting why you're going into sort of audio dramas as well, because I'm a musician. So, and we both kind of, I think, bucked the system when COVID tyranny took over.
Yeah.
And as a musician, I have, you know, my studio right here. I can make music, no problem. I can make pretty high level recordings on my own without any help. But a filmmaker, they need a lot more money. They need a team. They need support from those corporations a lot of the time. So when all that stuff happened and you were noticing all the propaganda around you and it was rubbing you the wrong way, did you end up speaking out or were you afraid to do so?
I would say I was generally afraid. I think at the beginning, like, so everything sort of started to hit me, you know, when COVID happened. I would say before that, it's not that I was afraid. It was more just that I didn't see it any of this intruding in my life at all. I was never, you know, overtly political or anything. I'm still not, I wouldn't say a political like person, like I don't talk about it on a daily basis, though now I am a very much more interested in it. But you know, my stories before that were fun, you know, satirical, you know, intelligent kind of things, but dealing more with like, you know, big universal themes. I made a feature film in the 2018-2019 period that was then released during COVID, but it was just about a digital nomad who wants to be like Indiana Jones and ends up getting stuck in New York, having to go from borough to borough, trying to find his way out, meeting all sorts of people. And it's really just about his internal struggle of, should he keep living this nomadic lifestyle or settle down in some way? And those kind of stories and those personal stories were really where my interests were. And it wasn't until everything locked down and they closed down all the gyms and swimming pools. I'm a big fitness person and I'm an avid swimmer, that I started to be, you know, really uncomfortable with what was going on. And I have luckily a few friends who I would talk about this stuff with. And it was over the next several months that I was like, okay, I guess I started to have more of an awakening. That said, you know, it was also during that period that I stopped really doing a lot of social media. I was always big on Instagram and trying to get my name out there, but I just stopped really feeling like it was important. So those things going hand in hand, like I never really felt like, I guess I never really felt like I would speak out in that format. And I was sort of waiting for the right moment and the right project to do that with. And, you know, that's Safe Society now.
So talk about Safe Society. It's an audio drama that you release on your podcast, or it's an audio podcast story. I mean, how do you do that? Do you have characters doing the voices?
Yeah, it's fully scripted.
Yeah.
So the backstory of it is that I was, and I still am, you know, interested in making feature films. It's just gotten so difficult, you know, like you pointed out, for especially for independent artists, if they're not hitting a certain messaging. But even before that, like, no independent films are getting funded now. You know, I was talking to a producer a couple of days ago. I mean, he was saying just that. I mean, the entire industry is basically shot after the SAG strikes. And no one really knows what it is. It could be the AI thing. It could just be general uncertainty. It could be the economy. I mean, it could be many things, but indie film is just, it's dead. It's going down the drain. And I kind of saw this coming a little bit because it was getting there last year. So as I was trying to get this feature film, the script out there, get name talent attached to it to help get funding, I was like, you know, this process is just going to take way too long. So I took that feature film script, which is about, you know, like 120 pages, which equates to about 2 hours of screen time. And I rewrote it so that it could work in the audio format. And I wasn't sure exactly what that would be yet, like how I would break it down. It ended up being a 3.5 hour kind of thing. And I was able to break that down on the page into 11 episodes. So there is a beginning, middle, end. It's very much a like a limited series, like a mini series. And I said, okay, it's the kind of thing that I could produce mainly myself for a fraction of the fee it costs to make a film. And then, you know, looking into it, I was like, okay, I could put this on Apple Podcasts. I could put it on Spotify. I can put it on all the major platforms pretty easily and at least get my creative juices flowing that way. And then who knows, maybe having this existing IP now can also help me leverage the film later on, because I am still interested in playing with the visual world and putting imagery to it in various ways.
That's amazing, man. I mean, a lot of people, you know, it, talk about lack of a victim mentality right there. You know, I respect that a lot. I mean,
well, you have to do it, right? I mean, art's like, you know, you have to, there's no way. And especially with a story like this, I was really urgent and eager to kind of get it going because it's contemporary. And I think it's interesting too, because now some of the things that it covers, like, you know, it uses COVID as a bit of a launching point. It doesn't say COVID straight out, but it's very clearly like, okay, there's a virus that's going on and there's a strain that's mutating, blah, 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 blah. And there's all these pushes that are happening from it. You know, like, obviously they're not pushing masks and vaccines as hard now. So some of those things that it does comment early on in the series are, you know, in the past, but I think that's also kind of interesting as almost historical fiction now, to kind of look back and say, hey, this is where our minds were at the time. And this is the kind of mass brainwashing and mass groupthink that was going on. So, you know, whether it's current or historical, I think it's still kind of interesting to examine our ability, especially when we kind of fall into groupthink, to get sidetracked and to take things too far.
How about overcoming obstacles, like internal obstacles is one of my favorite subjects because it's a constant battle with myself. Like there's a lot of projects I want to do and it's hard to focus. And if I feel like the chemtrails are spraying us with like anti-focus matter or something, if you even believe in chemtrails or whatever,
you know, where I've heard that. And I don't know if it's because like, you know, after, you know, everyone was like forced to lock down, they just got into that habit of like, you know, just sitting around like binging stuff or getting too comfortable working from home. I mean, I was always like working from home before that. So it was something that I've sort of been used to and how to like manage my day and constantly just kind of get my ideas down and work on things that way. So I don't think it was a big change for me that way. The biggest thing for me was really the fitness stuff. And that's what really hit me. Cause like I was swimming maybe like, you know, 4 or 5 times a week. And when that closed down, you know, I don't know if you've ever got in the pool and like done laps just, you know, recreationally or
dude, I do it every other day, like, man. Come on, let's talk swimming then. Swim. I do, Chris. Why? Is that hard to believe? I mean, don't I look like I'm a guy in pretty decent shape over here? Come on.
You do, but no, like a lot of people, it's a little bit of a niche kind of thing. It's not, I mean, especially when you talk about like a background, like, you know, I used to do it competitively. And then when college came, I was like, no, I'm not doing that. I'm not joining the team and doing 8 practices a week. I need to live and relax and focus on my own stuff a little bit. But it was something that I always wanted to keep up. So for some reason, it just stuck with me. And I love the feeling of, I don't do yoga and I don't meditate, but swimming is it's a very close thing for me because it's just a sense of rhythm when you're in the water and just kind of focusing on your breath, that kind of breathing pattern and the stroke pattern. It's very rhythmic and you get into that ritualistic feeling of like, of doing it that way. And I do interesting things with it. Like I switch up my workout. Like I do, I was listening to Peter Attia a couple months ago, and I think he was talking about like the proper way to do cardio and how like you want to do like, you know, level 2 stage cardio 2 days out of the week, and then a third day really, really push it and do like the speed training to push it that way. And I do something similar in the water where I do like more of a cardio workout on 2 of the days, and I do like a HIIT kind of workout on the third day. And then I intersperse it with gym workouts in between. I do, you know, I lift in between that. Because swimming doesn't really, it doesn't force your muscles to work after a certain point, and it doesn't build the bone density. So you kind of need to get, you know, get into the gym a little bit too. That's what I find.
I was swimming a few weeks ago, and there's this guy in the lane next to me, and he was doing the
butterfly. Arizona's a great place to do it, right? Because you can do it outside.
This is an indoor gym pool, and he's doing the butterfly stroke, right? And it's amazing. I'm watching him do it, and I'm like thinking, man, I've never even tried butterfly. I don't know how to do that at all. And so I'm kind of like on the other end of the pool, and he's taking a break, and I'm thinking, I wonder if he would tell me how to do it. So I sort of swim casually over to the, you know, other side of the pool where he is. And I go, man, that's a interesting stroke. Like, what do they call that? Fly fishing? I called it fly fishing, dude. I was like, it just came out of my mouth, fly fishing. And he goes, it's called butterfly. And I'm like, oh yeah, that's what I meant. And he goes, yeah, it's complicated. And then he went and kept swimming. He didn't teach me. So I'd never learned butterfly, and I lost the moment because I called it fly fishing, Chris.
You said you tried it for a lap?
No, I didn't try it at all. No, you didn't try it? That's a weird stroke, the butterfly.
It's very interesting to get used to. Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, you can do it?
Oh yeah. I mean, it's definitely like I can do like the four main disciplines. I mean, and I you know, I trained in that. It's something that like it takes a lot of endurance to do it properly. So you have to train it for sure.
It looks cool. I want to learn it. Anyway, let me take a quick break. We'll be right back to talk about fly fishing and art and all kinds of stuff right after these words on TNT.
TNT's Lembedopic.
I am always disappointed when I see civil servants, and he was a civil servant, he wasn't elected, preaching to the elected representatives of this country about what they should and shouldn't be doing. I wonder what his next job's going to be. Will it be in the green movement or somewhere else? Fundamentally, my issue is that Chris Stark assumes that everybody agrees that there is a climate emergency. And even more strangely, he thinks it's good for the British economy for us to invest in stopping this climate emergency.
Flip it. OPEC.
And today's news talk, TNT.
Affordable housing, we can build that. Sustainable housing, we can build that. At MIT Modular, we understand the importance of housing for all and the importance of design, cost, and functionality. Our goal is to meet the needs of our growing population by converting shipping containers to livable units. If you're like-minded and in a position to invest in something meaningful and life-changing, we want to hear from you. We are a team of professional architects, engineers, and financial and tax experts dedicated to offering unique solutions that provide a brighter future. Our Opportunity Zone Fund offers investors both real estate and operating business diversification, 5-year tax deferral on capital gains, annual tax benefits, and ultimately tax-free appreciation potential. There are Opportunity Zones all over America. If you're interested in learning more about our services, need affordable housing, or want to participate in creating a new vision for tomorrow, give us a call in the U.S. on 385-985-5702. Or read more at mitmodular.com. MIT Modular. We can build that.
It's time to switch on
today's news talk radio.
Very entertaining.
Yeah. TNT.
And we're back with professional fly fishing swimmer Chris Shimojima. I'm kidding. But he does know all the strokes. Fly fishing is not a swim stroke, by the way. It's something you do. You fish with a fly, I guess. I've never done it. Anyway, so Chris, talk about resistance, man. This is one of my favorite subjects as an artist. How do you overcome the internal struggles? Do you battle with self-esteem? Do you have periods where you can't focus and then you overcome? I don't know if you know that book, The War of Art, where Stephen Pressfield talks about overcoming resistance as an artist a lot. In this day and age, it seems, you know, like I was saying, people are struggling to make a living. There's distractions. We're all attached to our phones. How do you eke out the time to do your work and focus?
You know, the biggest thing for me, and the biggest thing that's always kind of blocking me is that I never feel like the audience is there. I mean, especially in the last few years, but I've been feeling it for some time. And part of it is social media, like you say, but it's also just that people are all in their own little bubbles now, and they all have their own interests. And because of the way streamers work and the content that's out there, everyone can get satiated with whatever they want, whenever. So we don't really have a common ground artistically. Like, everyone can just say, okay, what you're doing is cool, but I prefer this thing. My taste is in this thing. There's no real barometer. You know, you could say where the Oscars kind of used to be like the de facto American like film institution that would say, signal like, okay, this is a great film for people. You know, that doesn't really, it doesn't have that power anymore. People don't really feel like it speaks to them, or it doesn't really represent the kind of content that they're consuming or that's really out there. So this is really, it's really tough for independent filmmakers like myself, because we can't, you know, if we don't have that money or that audience, it's like, why? You always have to wonder, why do you keep doing it? And that's the thing that I feel a lot. It's, I wouldn't say it's a self-esteem thing, you know, because I do feel like, I always feel that I have the capability to do it and that I really want to do it. It's more of a sense of loneliness, I guess you would say, because it's hard to pull people into your mission and work with you on it. It's very hard to reach out to producers when they're all busy with their own projects. I mean, sometimes you'll hear back. And then if you do hear back, they'll string you on for several months, and then you'll just be back to square one. And I guess like the theme of my life, which I kind of connect back to various lessons that I learned as a kid, is that you kind of just have to do it yourself. And that's always led to something positive in the end for me. Or different lessons learned in a good way. But I've always felt that it was going to be a lonely task. And that's something I learned, like, you know, being that kid and that outsider, you know, having to train behind the piano and learn his music that way when, you know, other kids were playing. It's just something that was ingrained into me in a good way. I think we're all programmed in various ways. That's sort of one of the themes of Safe Society as well. You know, there's programming, and then there's ways programming can be used to control people in bad ways. But I think it's really just about that good programming and learning those lessons early on so that you can take that with you into adult life. So now, you know, every now and then, like, you know, especially with this one too, like, it was such a lonely endeavor just sitting at the computer here. I have a sound booth that I set up a couple feet away, and sometimes, and I would bring some of the talent in here to record some lines that I would need, but it's hours and hours of just like slaving away at the computer. And you just have to have your mindset and the end goal, which is like, hey, I have this creative urge. I have this story I want to tell. I just need to get it out there in whatever way possible.
Do you have a hard time creating content over consuming content? It seems to me like a lot of times I get in the loop of just consuming content and learning. Yeah. I mean, a lot of it's like really helpful content. Like, I'm learning, but then I'm learning. And as I learn how much I don't know. And then when I realize how much I don't know, it sort of like whittles away at my ability to do it. It's almost like you're talking about being programmed, and I think we all are programmed. How do you deprogram yourself? How do you become more of a content creator rather than a content consumer?
So I think part of the good things that I that happened to me were, you know, in the past few years, the kind of content that I consumed generally shifted over more toward talks and interviews and cultural news commentary kind of stuff. So all that became more inspiration for me and you know, material for me to kind of take in and put into my own creative projects versus, you know, sitting around watching Netflix and, you know, spending time consuming stories that way. Because I shifted over more to that content was definitely more inspirational. At the same time, a lot of the stuff that streamers and Netflix, you know, are putting out does not inspire me in many ways. So I had it easy. Like I've almost exclusively stopped watching that kind of stuff. And like I said before, I don't really use social media to the extent that I used to. It was just a process of, like, you know, becoming busy and then wanting to focus on my own things. So I had it easy because, like, a lot of the stuff that normally drew my interest stopped drawing my interest.
And so you've said a couple times that you don't really use social media as much, or you stopped using it at least during the COVID tyranny stuff, and you just mentioned it again. But isn't social media the way that we can find our audience? I mean, how are you getting your
stuff
out?
Well, it can be if you, what I find is that, yeah, what I found was that it could be a way to get a bigger audience if you really promote yourself actively on there, like as a full-time job. And that was something that I was never willing to do to begin with. It was just way too much of a hassle. And oftentimes, like, even if you put yourself out there, the way people scroll through this stuff, it's so much just a quick flick. You know, they just get a glimpse of it and they move on. So even if they, you know, they may like or comment on a post, it's really difficult to get them to engage with the content that you really want them to engage with beyond that, whether it's to watch the film or to get them onto the audio drama or whatnot. And this is something I've talked to with other audio drama creators as well, is that social media does not really help them in that way. You know, the way the audience comes is really just through word of mouth and, you know, kind of cross promoting with different dramas in that way. They really found that social media was not helpful.
That's interesting. So are you finding success with it? I mean, is that what you're doing? You're sort of cross, you know, advertising with other audio dramas and whatnot, or how are you?
Yeah, I'm starting to. There's one platform that I've been speaking with, which is it's called Apollo Podcasts, and they're specifically devoted to audio fiction, which is what Safe Society is. And they were really interested in getting this on the platform. And what differs it from, like, some of the other models is that it's all they have a subscription service where you pay, like, you know, $10 a month, and you can like put special content on there. You could put the entire series out there at once versus what I'm doing on Apple Podcasts, which is just kind of dropping two episodes at a time over a month. And if you subscribe to Apple Podcasts, part of that, a larger portion of those proceeds go directly to the creators. So it's much more helpful to the creator industry in that way. And so I've just been interested in working with them in that capacity.
And so you're living in New York City, right? I mean, or Queens anyway. And I'm a New Yorker. I've been there for 25 years, or I was there until I moved to Arizona. But
when did you move exactly? Finding,
almost 3 years ago now. I got out. And I never
that's when some
I
of my friends
leave.
Left too.
Yeah, a lot of people are leaving. How are you finding New York? Is it concerning to you? I mean, obviously the news reports all kinds of craziness and the sort of immigration stuff is wild. Are you concerned with staying there? Why do you stay there?
I'm generally concerned, but I'm also, you know, like you said, a bit of a New Yorker and a New Yorker at heart. So this is my territory. Like I've been here since, you know, I went to school at NYU. I grew up in Jersey. I've just been in this area my entire life. And I guess I do have a certain attachment to it. And I don't really want to give it up just yet. You know, my friends just were like, you know, screw it. They're leaving. I will say that, you know, where I am in the neighborhood I'm in Long Island City, just across the water in Queens. It's been fine. There was an instance where there was gunfire, you know, right outside our building. And the detectives came and everything. And that was really unusual for this neighborhood. That was about 2 years ago now. In general though, like because I do work from home quite a bit, I guess I do have it kind of easy being insulated. I do take the train in to get to the pool, you know, every other day. But I do feel like I've been fairly insulated so far.
So you're not worried. You're not planning on leaving anytime soon. I mean, I still love it there. I go there and play shows sometimes. It still has a good energy in general. Yeah. I mean, New York is, you know, it's a visceral.
Well, my hope
city.
Is
it's
that
emotional.
Yeah, my hope is that things will turn around for the better. That's, you know, that's partially why I'm sticking around, and partially because I do get attached to things very easily. And I like my place. I love my view, honestly. Like I love being able to just look across the water and look at the skyline. So my fear is always that, you know, when I do move, I'm just going to miss it so much. That's always been the things that really hit me. I have just intense attachments to places that I've lived at. Growing up in Jersey, we had a house there. And then the place we used to live in before that, I was like heartbroken when I had to leave from those places. So that's always the big thing that's holding me back. But who knows? Like, you know, I mean, we're thinking of starting a family, you know, pretty soon. So if we need that extra space, I mean, that's going to be a big thing to balance that I really have to think about for sure.
And you're thinking that it's going to get better. I mean, the world is all talking about how it's there. You know, I guess it's always been doomsday announcements, you know, throughout all of history.
I hope
of time,
that it will get better. I don't necessarily think it will, but I do hope that. I mean, everything works in cycles. I mean, the name of the book is not coming to me now, but it's really like an exploration of like how like history has worked in cyclical things. And we're now at like a certain point in that wheel. Before it hopefully goes around. I mean, it may take another 5 years or so or whatever before that revolution fully subsides, but yeah.
Well, what is this period of time done to you spiritually speaking? I mean, you know, like we're in such an extreme moment. It's the whole world has changed completely. It seems like, you know, it's getting crazier and crazier from the sort of doom scrolling worlds we all live in and distractions. To whatever is in the food and in the sky. I don't know if you took the jab or not, but I mean, it seems like humanity has altered and shifted. And you got Russell Brand now talking about getting baptized and sort of openly becoming Christian. Tucker Carlson's talking about how what Biden is going to run in is an anti-Christian agenda. I mean, it's very
Tucker's been talking about that a lot recently. No, I've been paying attention to that.
it's wild. He's coming out as like, God is real, evolution doesn't exist. Brett Weinstein's on X going like, you know, how dare Tucker? He didn't say how dare Tucker, but he's like, you know, evolution does exist. I mean, is the world round? Is it flat? Who knows? I mean, what's your take on all this? Are you a spiritual person? Are you praying? Has this made you more spiritual? Are you atheist?
So I grew up in, you know, my parents are Buddhist. And when I was younger, I would always ask them, well, what does that mean? Like, does that make me Buddhist also? And I guess their answer always was, well, we're not pushing anything onto you. And what it really just means is that you are a good person and you are doing good. And that we believe that there is a spiritual force out there, but we let people live and be themselves. And we hope for the best for them in that way. And that, I guess that always stuck with me. I never really got into religion or Christianity or anything after that. I've always been a spiritual individual. I mean, if that makes sense. Like, it's never the institution of what exactly that spiritual quality is was always less interesting to me. And it was more about how can that empower my individuality and my connection to the world through art. That was always my feeling about it. And I think it's impacted my work in many ways. It's just always been a sticking point. There is one other project that I'm hopefully trying to get going that delves, it is satirical also, and it delves more into the whole social media complex and someone who wants to be a motivational guru and uses all the tools of fame to get ahead and create a cult following around her. And what happens through that process and through this weird tech component that goes into it, where she's able to stream all of her five senses to anyone who puts on a headset, is that the spiritual boundaries, the physical boundaries begin to break down, and she becomes like a god in many ways. And I've always been interested in exploring, you know, what exactly that means, and how, you know, forms of technology and forms of, you know, ritual in this day and age can lead to people, you know, thinking they're creators or creating a following in that way. And then by the end That's of that story, like, weird stuff happens by the end of that story, where like she becomes she basically disappears into the non-material world. So all that stuff has always been
interesting. That's cool.
You know, like, yeah.
Where do you get a story idea like that? But don't answer that just yet. I really want to know that. And there's another question I have. If you believe in free will, manifestation, like, what's the Buddhist philosophy of that? Are we manifesting our reality, or is it all grace and mercy from on high? But let me take a quick break, and we'll be right back after these words on TNT.
From weather and traffic reports to news of political developments, we turn to journalists for the information we need to live our daily lives.
Journalists around the world provide the news that is essential for democracy,
for personal freedom, and for safety and stability.
Yet their ability to report freely and safely is under attack like never before.
So many journalists are paying with their lives.
They face exponential risks, and they've already paid a heavy toll.
Death threats, online harassment, and physical attacks
are becoming a daily experience of journalists in all countries.
We just want people to be safe, to be able to get our readers the information that they need to make informed decisions.
They checked my phone and realized that it was Pegasus. I feel myself like I am naked at the street.
These charges were politicized from the start.
Facts win. Truth wins. Justice wins.
C'est énorme pour moi d'être là, d'être libre. Surtout que je ne m'y attendais pas du tout.
Stand with a free press.
Stand with journalists whose reporting won't be silenced. Press freedom is your freedom.
Thank you.
We are for pets. We do anything for them because they do everything for us. We are for people, for those who love pets unconditionally. We are for good, from adoptions and veterinary care to disaster relief and fighting pet hunger. We stand together to create a better world for pets and families in need. We are PetSmart Charities. For pets, for people, for good.
Joseph Arthur and his Technicolor Dreamcast on today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
And we're back with Chris Shimojima. So, Chris, what is it? I really don't know. I have no idea the answer to this riddle. Do we have free will, or is everything of ourselves, we could do nothing, and it's all God's grace, or are we manifestors of our own reality? Both of those philosophies are compelling to me, and I'm not sure the answer. What do you think?
So honestly, I was going to say the same thing that I'm very uncertain about this. And it's something that's constantly on my mind, because I inject it into my stories in different ways. I mean, Safe Society, and then the other project I mentioned, they kind of talk about the forces that we're pawns to, or the forces that, you know, that are kind of controlling us in many ways. And they're kind of about people who are trying to break free from that and kind of exert their influence and their individuality and say, no, we're doing things because we have that, we have our own agenda and we're able to do that. But then the question also becomes is, you know, are we only a certain way because we grew up in the social environment that right. we grew up in, and how much impact does that have on us? So that's exactly the kind of thing that I wrestle with in these stories. And it's very difficult to get a clear answer on. I think that's the exact dilemma that I'm interested in exploring.
And what do you think beyond your stories, though, just in your own life? What's your inkling? Do you think that you're manifesting your reality, or do you think of yourself you can do nothing?
Well, my stories are a reflection of exactly how I feel about that. So it's very much the same thing. I will say that I do think that it's much more productive to think that you can do something about things. And even if there is, you know, that higher force that is guiding you and that you are fated to be a certain way, mm-hmm. because we can't know that day to day, it kind of doesn't matter. I mean, if you have to live day by day and just take it day by day, you have to go through it and live just acting as if you are only in that moment, and you have to just take it next step by step and do things that way. The only way to really stem off that existential crisis is to actually believe that you have agenda and that you can control things. Otherwise, you kind of sit back and just let things happen. And I think and to a certain extent, that's helpful also, because you always get in those ruts where you feel like for all the effort you put into something, you're not getting the result you want, and you kind of just have to let it be, and just have that wisdom to be like, okay, there's some things that I can't change, right? So there is that pull in that way too, but I think it's much more helpful for me to feel like I can make a difference. You know, I can't change things.
Well, there's truth in what you're saying, I guess, to a degree, but there's also the whole idea of seek first the Father and all else will be added on. So if your mind mm-hmm. space is that you aren't the driver of your own reality, but God is, then maybe your yeah. motivation each day is to tap into that source and allow him to work through you. And then that way, you know, because a lot of times we'll do things that are thought-based or ego-based. I don't know about you, but I've done lots of projects where it's all just like ego-driven, and it always ends up a mess or you know, not mm-hmm. very productive at all. Whereas I feel like if I'm tapping into source, or I'm guiding my mind towards, you know, seeking God's will with everything and sort of allowing revelation. I mean, when you talk about swimming, you know, that's when great ideas come, when you're sort of swimming and you're not thinking, and then all of a sudden, where does an idea come from? It's like a revelation. It's like a sort of a message where you're quieting your mind and the ego, or, you know, some people think that's the voice of the devil or something like that. And then God's revelations come into us, and then so if we operate from that space, perhaps you know, it's like we're sort of bending our will to his will, and then from there we can sort of operate yes. more productively.
Yes. You know, I think what you're saying and what I said actually kind of go hand in hand. I think it's really just almost like you're never perfectly aligned onto one perspective. Your mind shifts into these different perspectives as you're working. So at some instances, you're very much, okay, you have this thing that you need to get going and you need to do it. And you're the one with the keyboard in front of you. You need to type it out. At other moments, it is like you said, where you kind of just wait for that influence and inspiration to come in through that divine world, you know, and it you do let it come to you. I think we are kind of talking about the same thing. And it's really just a matter of sometimes your perspective is on one thing more and sometimes it's on the other thing more. And I think that you have to kind of think of it both ways in order to make progress. It's interesting because, you know, you create music and you paint, and those are things that are very much like you can get your id out there, right? You can let that flow happen. When I'm making a story and when I'm structuring something out, it's very technical. Like, it's very much like you have to, at least the way I work, because I'm trying to get a message through it. So I need to craft the exact beats and I need to know the ending and I need to work backwards and I need to plan all those things out. So I can't always just let myself be free and just kind of free flow it. You know what I mean? So I guess storytelling is a little bit different from other art forms in that way, in that there's a little bit more of a rational component that you kind of have to let yourself go to more often, I think.
You need both sides. It's the yin and the yang. You need to be able to, what did you call it?
Well, that's
it.
I don't even know really what
the id is. Is that like the super ego? What's the id?
The id is the one that's all the way inside, right? You have the super ego, the ego, and then the id. And the id is just like you letting out what you're channeling from that unconscious force that, you know, I think is tied to everyone's unconscious force in the world and everyone's inner spiritual being. Really.
Yeah. Well, then you have to organize it. So even in art or in music, there needs to be some sort of organization too. So
that's true too.
I mean, what did your parents do? How did you become an artist? Are they still living? Do they support your work? I mean, what's the story with your family life?
Yeah. You know, like I kind of mentioned before, my parents were always very much like you should do the things that empower you and you know, make you feel like you are contributing something. They are business people. You know, my mom, you know, she was a business individual and she would, work with different countries in terms of buying industrial pieces from them. And as a middleman, you know, selling these pieces to other people. And my dad was, in advertising on the branded side, working with, you know, he worked for Nestle for a time. He worked for Pepsi, AT&T. So he would go, you know, he was working for these different brands, creating marketing for them. And they are retired now. They're out in San Diego. So I do get to go there, quite a bit. My dad does still try to stay active because they were in business. They did always suggest that I should have that as a background. So especially in high school, they said, "All right, you have to take the business class electives and get some background on that." And I hated it. Like, I could never see how it applied to my life. I could never really, really connect it to anything I wanted to do. Like, I was always gravitating more to like the film class, you know, literature class, like all that kind of stuff. That's where my interest was. And I think at a certain point they kind of realized that. When I went to college, it was always between getting into film or getting into music composition. That was my other interest at the time, or doing something in film writing, which is what I ended up doing. And I think what they were satisfied about is that I was able to find a way to make that work in the business world. And that's, I guess, where the advertising thing came in, is that my skills, you know, especially as a filmmaker, were easily put to use when I was able to enter those companies after college.
Push comes to shove, what's the best movie of all time?
I can't answer that.
Oh, come on.
I would say
what's
that.
What's the top three? Give me top three.
Well, I can give you filmmakers. Like, I will say that, you know, I I grew up, you know, a big Scorsese fan. I still love Scorsese. Me too. And the other part of me is I'm a Spielberg fan. Like I grew up like, you know, with Indiana Jones, and Indiana Jones has always like been my inspiration as like an adventurer. You know, I do it in art, but it's still a big sensation for me to have that rush of like,
yeah.
And that's also why I told that other story about a digital nomad, like a guy who's just like being able to go all across the world and his, you know, living his own like misadventures and everything. So that's always been exciting to me. Part of me is also in that foreign film camp of like, I like Fellini, I like Bergman. Like I love the introspective nature of Bergman films and those small casts and him really delving into like
Bergman, right?
Yes. And those psychological character studies, right? And then part of me is really in that loose independent film New York world of Cassavetes and like just like letting people just kind of explode their emotions on screen. So I love all that. That's why it's so hard for me to pick favorite things.
Yeah, we used to go to Kim's Video down there in the East Village.
Yeah, of course.
Like hipster art or Two Boots. They used to have the video rental at Two Boots Pizza over there. And we used to go there. That used to be the big night out. You know, go rent a movie and, you know, like, simpler times, my friend. So
I know.
You're talking about digital nomad and all that. It reminds me of the simulation. Do you think we're in a simulation? This idea was hard for me to get my head around at first. But the more I hear about it, the more it seems somewhat compelling. I mean, what Elon Musk is saying, if you look at the way video games are progressing, it used to be Pong. And now it's almost hard to tell the difference between reality and video games.
Listen, I've been thinking this since The Matrix came out. I mean, that was such an influential movie to me. And then they tried to tap back into it with the latest Matrix sequel, Matrix Resurrections, right? And I don't think they did. They did a great job at it. But no, like, I mean, these were like thoughts that were swirling around my head, you know, in college when that came out. And I was like, so, you know, where my stance on is now is that it's entirely possible. I feel like, again, it goes back to what I was saying before, is that it's not necessarily helpful for me to think that way, because then I lose my own sense of agenda. So in order for me to go about doing things day to day, I kind of have to put that thought aside, even though I do think it's entirely possible. And just work from the feeling of, okay, listen, I have control over what I'm doing here in this world. And maybe it is all a simulation, but day to day, we can't know that. We are stuck in this world, unless maybe there is a way to break free.
I saw The Matrix for the first time. In Union Square in the theater. I went with some friends. Oh, it was like a Friday night kind of thing. And it was like, oh, the new Keanu Reeves action movie's out. And that's all. I didn't hear anything about it before that. Fan of Keanu Reeves. Actually, I played a party for him one time. I got to know him a little bit. Yeah. Shout out Keanu Reeves. He's a great guy. But so I thought, this was before I knew him, but I thought, oh, it's just like going to be Speed or, you know, a dumb Keanu Reeves action movie. I should say fun, not dumb. But, you know, I didn't think it was going to be mind-blowing, a mind-bending experience. So I walked in there just completely oblivious to what I was about to witness. And it was just like, as it unfolded, I was just like, oh my God, this is,
man. And to have that experience
going like, that's incredible. Yeah. What?
No, to have that experience in a cinema, what must've been amazing. Like I was too young, like at that moment. Dude. So I saw it on DVD and home video. Like I think my first glimpse of it was like playing at like a friend's house. And I was like, wait, what is that? And then I was able to watch the full thing like a couple months later. But it was like on the small screen and things were not HD at that time. So it was like, you know, DVD and all that.
Yeah.
And like, God, I wish I could go back now and see it like that. That would have been.
Yeah. And plus you were probably prepared. Like people probably told you, oh, The Matrix, you got to see it. It's awesome. I mean, there was no preparation. I think his movie before that was Speed or something. You know what I mean? It was like fun popcorn action movies, you know, and that's what I thought I was in for, like something silly.
I remember like a few years ago, or I guess it was longer than that now, maybe like a decade ago, when Inception came out, and like people started comparing that to like this generation's Matrix or whatever, and it never did the same thing for me. I mean, it's a perfectly fine movie, but it never really tapped into that spiritual component and like that metaphysical component the way the Matrix did. And it was really just such a clear distillation of that hero's journey through that it just did it so well.
Incredible. You want to know one of the best movies of all time? More recent?
Yeah, go. What is it?
Training Day. Ethan Hawke.
Denzel, you know what? That was pretty great. But that's not recent either. That came out a few years ago.
Well, it's recent to me, dude. I'm like 45 years older than you. Like, to me, it seems like it was out last week, even though I've seen it a bunch of times. Yeah, Denzel won the Oscar for that. That was so good, man. And Ethan Hawke. Ethan Hawke's kind of underrated, I think.
Ethan Hawke's amazing. He did a really, you should check this one. He did a crazy movie for Abel Ferreira. You know that filmmaker?
Yeah.
He did something for him a couple years ago where he plays this like very anti-establishment kind of like almost terrorist-like figure. And he goes he goes crazy in it. Like he's been going crazy in a lot of roles, you know?
He's awesome. Chris, thank you for coming on, man. Tell everyone where to find you, even though you're not on social media that much. Tell people where to your podcast and all that.
You can still find me on Instagram, CShimo, or you can find Safe Society on all of the major audio platforms, Apple Podcasts, Amazon Music, Spotify, or you could really just go to safesociety.world and all the listen links are on there and links to my work are on there as well.
All right, Chris, thanks for coming on, man.
Keep listening to TNT,
everybody. We'll see you soon. Keep listening. We'll be right back.